He had not suspected such familiar intimacy between them. Well, that's enough. Anyway, Ivan cut short the conversation. I am going. I'll come too, tomorrow. And turning at once, he walked out of the room and went straight downstairs. With an imperious gesture, Katerina Ivanovna seized Alyosha by both hands. Follow him. Overtake him. Don't leave him alone for a minute, she said, in a hurried whisper. He's mad. Don't you know that he's mad? He is in a fever, nervous fever. The doctor told me so. Go, run after him. Alyosha jumped up and ran after Ivan, who was not 50 paces ahead of him. What do you want? He turned quickly on Alyosha, seeing that he was running after him. She told you to catch me up, because I'm mad. I know it all by heart, he added irritably. She is mistaken, of course, but she's right that you are ill, said Alyosha. I was looking at your face just now. You look very ill, Ivan. Ivan walked on without stopping. Alyosha followed him. And do you know, Alexey Fyodorovich, how people do go out of their minds? Ivan asked in a voice suddenly quiet, without a trace of irritation, with a note of the simplest curiosity. No, I don't. I suppose there are all kinds of insanity. And can one observe that one's going mad oneself? I imagine one can't see oneself clearly in such circumstances, Alyosha answered with surprise. Ivan paused for half a minute. If you want to talk to me, please change the subject, he said suddenly. Oh, while I think of it, I have a letter for you, said Alyosha timidly, and he took Liza's note from his pocket and held it out to Ivan. They were just under a lamp post. Ivan recognized the handwriting at once. Ah, from that little demon. He laughed maliciously, and, without opening the envelope, he tore it into bits and threw it in the air. The bits were scattered by the wind. She's not 16 yet, I believe, and already offering herself, he said contemptuously, striding along the street again. How do you mean, offering herself? Exclaimed Alyosha. As wanton women offer themselves, to be sure. How can you, Ivan, how can you? Alyosha cried warmly, in a grieved voice. She is a child, you are insulting a child. She is ill, she is very ill, too. She is on the verge of insanity, too, perhaps. I had hoped to hear something from you. That would save her. You'll hear nothing from me. If she is a child, I am not her nurse. Be quiet, Alexey. Don't go on about her. I am not even thinking about it. They were silent again for a moment. She will be praying all night now to the Mother of God to show her how to act tomorrow at the trial, he said sharply and angrily again. You. You mean Katerina Ivanovna? Yes. Whether she's to save Mityu or ruin him. She'll pray for light from above. She can't make up her mind for herself, you see. She has not had time to decide yet. She takes me for her nurse, too. She wants me to sing lullabies to her. Katerina Ivanovna loves you, brother, said Alyosha sadly. Perhaps, but I am not very keen on her. She is suffering. Why do you sometimes say things to her that give her hope? Alyosha went on, with timid reproach. I know that you've given her hope. Forgive me for speaking to you like this, he added. I can't behave to her as I ought, break off altogether and tell her so straight out, said Ivan, irritably. I must wait till sentence is passed on the murderer. If I break off with her now, she will avenge herself on me by ruining that scoundrel tomorrow at the trial, for she hates him and knows she hates him. It's all a lie, lie upon lie. As long as I don't break off with her, she goes on hoping, and she won't ruin that monster, knowing how I want to get him out of trouble. If only the damned verdict would come. The words murderer and monster echoed painfully in Alyosha's heart. But how can she ruin Mitya? He asked, pondering on Ivan's words. What evidence can she give that would ruin Mitya? You don't know that yet. She's got a document in her hands, in Mitya's own writing, That proves conclusively that he did murder Fyodor Pavlovich. That's impossible, cried Alishaw. Why is it impossible? I've read it myself. There can't be such a document, Alishaw repeated warmly. There can't be, because he's not the murderer. It's not he murdered father, not he. Ivan suddenly stopped. Who is the murderer then, according to you? He asked, with apparent coldness. There was even a supercilious note in his voice. You know who, Alishaw pronounced in a low, penetrating voice. Who? You mean the myth about that crazy idiot, the epileptic, Smerdyakov? Alishaw suddenly felt himself trembling all over. You know who, broke helplessly from him. He could scarcely breathe. Who? Who? Ivan cried almost fiercely. All his restraint suddenly vanished. I only know one thing, Alishaw went on, still almost in a whisper, it wasn't you killed father. Not you. What do you mean by not you? Ivan was thunderstruck. It was not you killed father, not you. Alishaw repeated firmly. The silence lasted for half a minute. I know I didn't. Are you raving? Said Ivan, with a pale, distorted smile. His eyes were riveted on Alishaw. They were standing again under a lamp post. No, Ivan. You've told yourself several times that you are the murderer. When did I say so? I was in Moscow. When have I said so? Ivan faltered helplessly. You've said so to yourself many times, when you've been alone during these two dreadful months, Alishaw went on softly and distinctly as before. Yet he was speaking now, as it were, not of himself, not of his own will, but obeying some irresistible command. You have accused yourself and have confessed to yourself that you are the murderer and no one else. But you didn't do it, you are mistaken, you are not the murderer. Do you hear? It was not you. God has sent me to tell you so. They were both silent. The silence lasted a whole long minute. They were both standing still, gazing into each other's eyes. They were both pale. Suddenly Ivan began trembling all over, and clutched Alishaw's shoulder. You've been in my room. He whispered hoarsely. You've been there at night, when he came. Confess. Have you seen him? Have you seen him? Whom do you mean, Mitya? Alishaw asked, bewildered. Not him, damn the monster. Ivan shouted, in a frenzy. Do you know that he visits me? How did you find out? Speak. Who is he? I don't know whom you are talking about, Alishaw faltered, beginning to be alarmed. Yes, you do know. Or how could you? It's impossible that you don't know. Suddenly he seemed to check himself. He stood still and seemed to reflect. A strange grin contorted his lips. Brother, Alishaw began again, in a shaking voice, I have said this to you, because you'll believe my word, I know that. I tell you once and for all, it's not you. You hear, once for all. God has put it into my heart to say this to you, even though it may make you hate me from this hour. But by now Ivan had apparently regained his self-control. Alexei Fyodorovich, he said, with a cold smile, I can't endure prophets and epileptics, messengers from God especially, and you know that only too well. I break off all relations with you from this moment and probably forever. I beg you to leave me at this turning. It's the way to your lodgings, too. You'd better be particularly careful not to come to me today. Do you hear? He turned and walked on with a firm step, not looking back. Brother, Alishaw called after him, if anything happens to you today, turn to me before anyone. But Ivan made no reply. Alishaw stood under the lamp, post at the crossroads, till Ivan had vanished into the darkness. Then he turned and walked slowly homewards. Both Alishaw and Ivan were living in lodgings, neither of them was willing to live in Fyodor Pavlovich's empty house. Alishaw had a furnished room in the house of some working people. Ivan lived some distance from him. He had taken a roomy and fairly comfortable lodge attached to a fine house that belonged to a well. To lady, the widow of an official. but his only attendant was a deaf and rheumatic old crone who went to bed at 6 o'clock every evening and got up at 6 in the morning. Ivan had become remarkably indifferent to his comforts of late, and very fond of being alone. He did everything for himself in the one room he lived in, and rarely entered any of the other rooms in his abode. He reached the gate of the house and had his hand on the bell, when he suddenly stopped. He felt that he was trembling all over with anger. Suddenly he let go of the bell, turned back with a curse, and walked with rapid steps in the opposite direction. He walked a mile and a half to a tiny, slanting, wooden house, almost a hut, where Maria Kondratovna, the neighbor who used to come to Fyodor Pavlovich's kitchen for soup and to whom Smerdyakov had once sung his songs and played on the guitar, was now lodging. She had sold their little house, and was now living here with her mother. Smerdyakov, who was ill, almost dying, had been with them ever since Fyodor Pavlovich's death. It was to him Ivan was going now, drawn by a sudden and irresistible prompting. Chapter 6, the first interview with Smerdyakov. This was the third time that Ivan had been to see Smerdyakov since his return from Moscow. The first time he had seen him and talked to him was on the first day of his arrival, then he had visited him once more, a fortnight later. But his visits had ended with that second one, so that it was now over a month since he had seen him. And he had scarcely heard anything of him. Ivan had only returned 5 days after his father's death, so that he was not present at the funeral, which took place the day before he came back. The cause of his delay was that Alishaw, not knowing his Moscow address, had to apply to Katerina Ivanovna to telegraph to him, and she, not knowing his address either, telegraphed to her sister and aunt, reckoning on Ivan's going to see them as soon as he arrived in Moscow. But he did not go to them till 4 days after his arrival. When he got the telegram, he had, of course, set off post, haste to our town. The first to meet him was Alishaw, and Ivan was greatly surprised to find that, in opposition to the general opinion of the town, he refused to entertain a suspicion against Mitya, and spoke openly of Smerdyakov as the murderer. Later on, after seeing the police captain and the prosecutor, and hearing the details of the charge and the arrest, he was still more surprised at Alishaw, and ascribed his opinion only to his exaggerated brotherly feeling and sympathy with Mitya, of whom Alishaw, as Ivan knew, was very fond. By the way, let us say a word or two of Ivan's feeling to his brother Dmitri. He positively disliked him, at most, felt sometimes a compassion for him, and even that was mixed with great contempt, almost repugnance. Mitya's whole personality, even his appearance, was extremely unattractive to him. Ivan looked with indignation on Katerina Ivanovna's love for his brother. Yet he went to see Mitya on the first day of his arrival, and that interview, far from shaking Ivan's belief in his guilt, positively strengthened it. He found his brother agitated, nervously excited. Mitya had been talkative, but very absent, minded and incoherent. He used violent language, accused Smerdyakov, and was fearfully muddled. He talked principally about the 3,000 rubles, which he said had been stolen from him by his father. "The money was mine, it was my money," Mitya kept repeating. "Even if I had stolen it, I should have had the right." He hardly contested the evidence against him, and if he tried to turn a fact to his advantage, it was in an absurd and incoherent way. He hardly seemed to wish to defend himself to Ivan or anyone else. Quite the contrary, he was angry and proudly scornful of the charges against him. He was continually firing up and abusing everyone. He only laughed contemptuously at Grigory's evidence about the open door, and declared that it was the devil that opened it. But he could not bring forward any coherent explanation of the fact. He even succeeded in insulting Ivan during their first interview, telling him sharply that it was not for people who declared that everything was lawful, to suspect and question him. Altogether he was anything but friendly with Ivan on that occasion. Immediately after that interview with Mitya, Ivan went for the first time to see Smerdyakov. In the railway train on his way from Moscow, He kept thinking of Smerdyakov and of his last conversation with him on the evening before he went away. Many things seemed to him puzzling and suspicious. When he gave his evidence to the investigating lawyer, Ivan said nothing, for the time, of that conversation. He put that off till he had seen Smerdyakov, who was at that time in the hospital. Dr. Herzenstube and Varvinsky, the doctor he met in the hospital, confidently asserted in reply to Ivan's persistent questions, that Smerdyakov's epileptic attack was unmistakably genuine, and were surprised indeed at Ivan asking whether he might not have been shamming on the day of the catastrophe. They gave him to understand that the attack was an exceptional one, the fits persisting and recurring several times, so that the patient's life was positively in danger, and it was only now, after they had applied remedies, that they could assert with confidence that the patient would survive. Though it might well be, added Dr. Herzenstube, that his reason would be impaired for a considerable period, if not permanently. On Ivan's asking impatiently whether that meant that he was now mad, they told him that this was not yet the case, in the full sense of the word, but that certain abnormalities were perceptible. Ivan decided to find out for himself what those abnormalities were. At the hospital he was at once allowed to see the patient. Smerdyakov was lying on a truckle bed in a separate ward. There was only one other bed in the room, and in it lay a tradesman of the town, swollen with dropsy, who was obviously almost dying. He could be no hindrance to their conversation. Smerdyakov grinned uncertainly on seeing Ivan, and for the first instant seemed nervous. So at least Ivan fancied. But that was only momentary. For the rest of the time he was struck, on the contrary, by Smerdyakov's composure. From the first glance Ivan had no doubt that he was very ill. He was very weak, he spoke slowly, seeming to move his tongue with difficulty. He was much thinner and sallower. Throughout the interview, which lasted 20 minutes, he kept complaining of headache and of pain in all his limbs. His thin emasculate face seemed to have become so tiny, his hair was ruffled, and his crest of curls in front stood up in a thin tuft. But in the left eye, which was screwed up and seemed to be insinuating something, Smerdyakov showed himself unchanged. It's always worthwhile speaking to a clever man. Ivan was reminded of that at once. He sat down on the stool at his feet. Smerdyakov, with painful effort, shifted his position in bed, but he was not the first to speak. He remained dumb, and did not even look much interested. "Can you talk to me?" asked Ivan. "I won't tire you much." "Certainly I can," mumbled Smerdyakov, in a faint voice. "Has your honor been back long?" he added patronizingly, as though encouraging a nervous visitor. "I only arrived today. To see the mess you are in here." Smerdyakov sighed. "Why do you sigh?" "You knew of it all along," Ivan blurted out. Smerdyakov was stolidly silent for a while. "How could I help knowing? It was clear beforehand. But how could I tell it would turn out like that?" "What would turn out?" "Don't prevaricate. You foretold you'd have a fit on the way down to the cellar, you know. You mentioned the very spot." "Have you said so at the examination yet?" Smerdyakov queried with composure. Ivan felt suddenly angry. "No, I haven't yet, but I certainly shall. You must explain a great deal to me, my man, and let me tell you, I am not going to let you play with me. Why should I play with you, when I put my whole trust in you, as in God Almighty?" said Smerdyakov, with the same composure, only for a moment closing his eyes. "In the first place," began Ivan, "I know that epileptic fits can't be told beforehand. I've inquired, don't try and take me in. You can't foretell the day and the hour. How was it you told me the day and the hour beforehand, and about the cellar, too? How could you tell that you would fall down the cellar stairs in a fit, if you didn't sham a fit on purpose?" "I had to go to the cellar anyway, several times a day, indeed," Smerdyakov drawled deliberately. "I fell from the garret just in the same way a year ago. It's quite true you can't tell the day and hour of a fit beforehand, but you can always have a presentiment of it. But you did foretell the day and the hour. In regard to my epilepsy, sir, you had much better inquire of the doctors here. You can ask them whether it was a real fit or a sham, it's no use my saying any more about it. And the seller. How could you know beforehand of the seller? You don't seem able to get over that seller. As I was going down to the cellar, I was in terrible dread and doubt. What frightened me most was losing you and being left without defense in all the world. So I went down into the cellar thinking, here, it'll come on directly, it'll strike me down directly, shall I fall? And it was through this fear that I suddenly felt the spasm that always comes. And so I went flying. All that and all my previous conversation with you at the gate the evening before, when I told you how frightened I was and spoke of the cellar, I told all that to Dr. Hertz and Stuben Nikolay Parfenovich, the investigating lawyer, and it's all been written down in the protocol. And the doctor here, Mr. Varvinsky, maintained to all of them that it was just the thought of it brought it on, the apprehension that I might fall. It was just then that the fit seized me. And so they've written it down, that it's just how it must have happened, simply from my fear. As he finished, Smerdyakov drew a deep breath, as though exhausted. Then you have said all that in your evidence? Said Ivan, somewhat taken aback. He had meant to frighten him with the threat of repeating their conversation, and it appeared that Smerdyakov had already reported it all himself. What have I to be afraid of? Let them write down the whole truth, Smerdyakov pronounced firmly. And have you told them every word of our conversation at the gate? And did you tell them that you can sham fits, as you boasted then? No, I didn't tell them that either. Tell me now, why did you send me then to Chemashnya? I was afraid you'd go away to Moscow, Chemashnya is nearer, anyway. You're lying. You suggested my going away yourself, you told me to get out of the way of trouble. That was simply out of affection and my sincere devotion to you, for seeing trouble in the house, to spare you. Only I wanted to spare myself even more. That's why I told you to get out of harm's way, that you might understand that there would be trouble in the house, and would remain at home to protect your father. You might have said it more directly, you blockhead. Ivan suddenly fired up. How could I have said it more directly then? It was simply my fear that made me speak, and you might have been angry, too. I might well have been apprehensive that Dmitri Fyodorovich would make a scene and carry away that money, for he considered it as good as his own, but who could tell that it would end in a murder like this? I thought that he would only carry off the 3,000 that lay under the master's mattress in the envelope, and you see, he's murdered him. How could you guess it either, sir? But if you say yourself that it couldn't be guessed, how could I have guessed and stayed at home? You contradict yourself, said Ivan, pondering. You might have guessed from my sending you to Chemashnya and not to Moscow. How could I guess it from that? Smerdyakov seemed much exhausted, and again he was silent for a minute. You might have guessed from the fact of my asking you not to go to Moscow, but to Chemashnya, that I wanted to have you nearer, for Moscow's a long way off, and Dmitri Fyodorovich, knowing you are not far off, would not be so bold. And if anything had happened, you might have come to protect me, too, for I warned you of Grigory Vasilievich's illness, and that I was afraid of having a fit. And when I explained those knocks to you, by means of which one could go into the deceased, and that Dmitri Fyodorovich knew them all through me, I thought that you would guess yourself that he would be sure to do and so wouldn't go to Chemashnya even, but would stay. He talks very coherently, thought Ivan, though he does mumble. What's the derangement of his faculties that Hertz and Stube talked of? You are cunning with me, damn you! He exclaimed, getting angry. But I thought at the time that you quite guessed, Smerdyakov parried with the simplest air. If I'd guessed, I should have stayed, cried Ivan. Why, I thought that it was because you guessed, that you went away in such a hurry, only to get out of trouble, only to run away and save yourself in your fright. You think that everyone is as great a coward as yourself? Forgive me, I thought you were like me. Of course, I ought to have guessed, Ivan said in agitation, and I did guess there was some mischief brewing on your part. Only you are lying, you are lying again, he cried, suddenly recollecting. Do you remember how you went up to the carriage and said to me, it's always worthwhile speaking to a clever man? So you were glad I went away, since you praised me? Smerdyakov sighed again and again. A trace of color came into his face. If I was pleased, he articulated rather breathlessly, it was simply because you agreed not to go to Moscow, but to Chemashnya. For it was nearer, anyway. Only when I said these words to you, it was not by way of praise, but of reproach. You didn't understand it. What reproach? Why, that foreseeing such a calamity you deserted your own father, and would not protect us, for I might have been taken up any time for stealing the 3,000. Damn you! Ivan swore again. Stay. Did you tell the prosecutor and the investigating lawyer about those knocks? I told them everything just as it was. Ivan wondered inwardly again. If I thought of anything then, he began again, it was solely of some wickedness on your part. Dmitri might kill him, but that he would steal, I did not believe that then. But I was prepared for any wickedness from you. You told me yourself you could sham a fit. What did you say that for? It was just through my simplicity, and I never have shammed a fit on purpose in my life. And I only said so then to boast to you. It was just foolishness. I liked you so much then, and was open-hearted with you. My brother directly accuses you of the murder and theft. What else is left for him to do? Said Smerdyakov, with a bitter grin. And who will believe him with all the proofs against him? Grigory Vasilievich saw the door open. What can he say after that? But never mind him. He is trembling to save himself. He slowly ceased speaking, then suddenly, as though on reflection, added, and look here again. He wants to throw it on me and make out that it is the work of my hands, I've heard that already. But as to my being clever at shamming a fit, should I have told you beforehand that I could sham one, if I really had had such a design against your father? If I had been planning such a murder, could I have been such a fool as to give such evidence against myself beforehand? And to his son, too. Upon my word. Is that likely? As if that could be, such a thing has never happened. No one hears this talk of ours now, except Providence itself, and if you were to tell of it to the prosecutor and Nikolay Parfenovich, you might defend me completely by doing so, for who would be likely to be such a criminal, if he is so open-hearted beforehand? Anyone can see that. Well, and Ivan got up to cut short the conversation, struck by Smerdyakov's last argument. I don't suspect you at all, and I think it's absurd, indeed, to suspect you. On the contrary, I am grateful to you for setting my mind at rest. Now I am going, but I'll come again. Meanwhile, good, bye. Get well. Is there anything you want? I am very thankful for everything. Marfa Ignatyevna does not forget me, and provides me anything I want, according to her kindness. Good people visit me every day. Good, bye. But I shan't say anything of your being able to sham a fit, and I don't advise you to, either, something made Ivan say suddenly. I quite understand. And if you don't speak of that, I shall say nothing of that conversation of ours at the gate. Then it happened that Ivan went out, and only when he had gone a dozen steps along the corridor, he suddenly felt that there was an insulting significance in Smerdyakov's last words. He was almost on the point of turning back, but it was only a passing impulse, and muttering, nonsense. He went out of the hospital. His chief feeling was one of relief at the fact that it was not Smerdyakov, but Mitya, who had committed the murder, though he might have been expected to feel the opposite. He did not want to analyze the reason for this feeling, and even felt a positive repugnance at prying into his sensations. He felt as though he wanted to make haste to forget something. In the following days he became convinced of Mitya's guilt, as he got to know all the weight of evidence against him. There was evidence of people of no importance, Fenya and her mother, for instance, but the effect of it was almost overpowering. As to Perhotin, the people at the tavern, and at Plotnikov's shop, as well as the witnesses at Mokro, their evidence seemed conclusive.